Good evening. Welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. My name is Gina Bellaria, former director of literary events here at the Commonwealth Club and current founder of Bellaria Creative. It's my pleasure to introduce Emmanuel Jolish. Am I saying that? Yes. Israeli-American psychologist. A self-proclaimed student of the Middle East, Jolish was born in a German displacement camp in 1947 to Holocaust survivors. His family immigrated to Israel in 1948. Jolish came to the U.S. in 1969, where he earned his PhD in psychology and also practiced here as a clinical psychologist. He has spent the bulk of his professional life pondering the Middle East conflict and has insights and ideas that he'll be introducing and discussing tonight. He hopes to find a way to allow Israelis and Palestinians to give up their mutual senses of victimhood, abandon, and current facades of justice and focus on tactical solutions. He visits Israel regularly, maintains contact with Israeli academics, and reads Israeli and Arabic newspapers voraciously. And now, it is my pleasure to introduce, to present his Steps for Peace in the Middle East, Emmanuel Jolish.
Can everybody hear me? Okay. First, I'd like to mention that the announcement in the Examiner elevated me from being a student of the Middle East to being a scholar. So I'd like to correct that. I'm still very much the student. There are very few scholars of this matter. What I will do today is, in fact, do what I usually advise people not to do is read my presentation, because those of you who know me well enough, and a few of you there out there, know that I tend to be verbose. And in order to control that, I am going to read and then hopefully be able to answer any questions that you have. So here goes. Arabs and Jews have been unable to reach a viable peace settlement in the Middle East conflict, of the Middle East conflicts, through direct talks, indirect talks, and direct and third-party mediators. It is noteworthy that all parties involved in the conflict have known the precise formula to achieve peace in the Middle East. Wise men and women have been discussing the terms for over 50 years, probably more like 60. There are confidence-building measures, detailed plans, and timetables that deal with every aspect of the problem. I've seen accords that are 400 or 500 pages long. Many prominent individuals, including most U.S. secretaries of state and two presidents, have spent a great deal of time and energy to bring the two sides together. Since the beginning of the conflict in the late 19th century, 1881, 1882, we have seen empires fall, two world wars, the beginning and the end of the Cold War, 64 years of relative peace in Europe, and even a resolution of the Irish conflict. During the same period of time, we have had seven wars between Muslims and Jews with no end in sight. This begs the question, why are the parties to the conflict still at it? What makes the Middle East conflict so resistant to any resolution? My hypothesis is that the parties and mediators are failing because they are focused exclusively on the second phase of the remedy. Specifically, they devote all of their efforts to the technical and logistical aspects of the solution. It is the tactic preceding the strategy. I would recommend moving from point A to point B rather than from point B to point A. The first phase of point A is the psychological aspect of the conflict. In my career as a psychologist, I learned that the solution to a marital conflict is available to the feuding spouses and their psychologists shortly following the commencement of treatment. So you can see what I'm doing here is I'm viewing both parties as a feuding couple coming into my office. And I'm going to tell myself, good luck, Emmanuel. So So the solution is known. The trained professional has to learn ways to deal with the very forces that make the couple resist any movement toward progress. A premature attempt to move to phase 2B will most likely result in entrenchment and immobility. Moreover, the feuding spouses will attempt to draw the mediator into the conflict. Such a process is doomed to failure from the get-go. And the best example I can come up with is Clinton and Camp David. You know, being the mediator, being the psychologist, pushing the two sides together, and the result, a huge explosion, the Intifada. A leading treatment modality of the latter part of the 20th century is cognitive behavioral therapy that postulates that a psychologist needs to assist his patients to closely examine their attitudes, thoughts, and the underlying assumptions that they hold in order to achieve understanding of the core or the root problem. And as you can tell, that I did practice psychology for 20 years, and I used primarily, if not exclusively, this very treatment modality, which is entirely different than most things that you know. It's not Freudian or Jungian or any of that sort. So I'll talk for about 2 minutes about the modality, about the treatment. Allow me to introduce an illustration of the cognitive therapy principle. A person is standing in line to purchase tickets at the theater in the evening hours. Suddenly, he feels two pokes at his back. So the person becomes highly irritable, angry, and ready to strike back. As he turns, he notices a person holding a white cane and wearing sunglasses. It is evening. The anger dissipates. The urge to strike is displaced by a sense of empathy and wish to assist. Yes, that person poking him is blind. A change in a person's underlying assumptions of the situation may change the emotional state. That person is no longer angry. Moreover, the alternate explanation of the event may move the individual toward a cooperative mood. It is not the actual mechanics of the poking that contributes to a person's emotional state, but the interpretation of the event. And that is the core of what cognitive psychology or cognitive behavioral therapy is all about. It's the interpretation, not just the event. The patterns of thoughts may have a powerful effect on the couple's emotional state. The feuding spouses need to change these patterns of thought that support and reinforce the dysfunctional relationship and the anger and hatred involved. Each spouse creates his or her own reality by adhering to a particular narrative. The new narrative may become this person's irrefutable reality, almost like a religious held belief. Treatment tries to identify the dysfunctional thoughts and distortion, examine the evidence, test the validity of the thoughts, define the terms used. In short, take an analytic approach. Once the psychologist helps the couple change the dysfunctional pattern of thoughts, it will move on to a second phase of treatment. So treatment, you know, the behavioral changes come at point B. Being self-critical and examining one's emotional state are extremely difficult. Hopefully, I will not underestimate the difficulty. However, this needs to take place prior to and not following the concrete behavioral changes and compromises. Failing to do so may exacerbate the conflict due to increased expectations, frustration, and disappointment by the involved party. And that is exactly what happened after the failure of the peace talks, again going back to Clinton. It made things worse. My conclusion, or somewhat one of the many conclusions, is that at times no treatment is preferable to faulty intervention by a third party. What are some of the positions and attitudes that are held by the parties to the conflict that make this one of the most intractable conflicts of the 19th, 20th, and now the 21st centuries? Well, let me present the following core beliefs of each side and address each one of the core of the beliefs. A little self-disclosure, the article appeared, or the description said there are only 10 points. However, I wanted to give my peoples their money's worth, so I'm giving them 19 points. So 9 extra points just for you guys. 1, the search for peace in the Middle East is about achievement of redemption and justice. Moreover, it is about the removal of the humiliation and lost pride, honor, and prestige. To redeem ourselves, it is justified to pursue any avenue and mode of action. The goal is victory. The end justifies the means. What am I saying about this? This idea allows the emotional state of Muslims to dictate their reality. Again, you are moving into a cognitive state that is motivated by emotions. Humiliation will be removed by humiliating the opponent. This is similar to blood feuds within certain Arab cultures and reminds me of the analogy or the story of the blind man, you know, an eye for an eye, then, you know, eventually everybody's going to go blind. Some Jews say that Palestinian Muslims are not a nation or distinct people. They are part of the larger Arab nation. This idea must change, as it is not the Jews who have the right to determine the national identity of other people. This is actually one of the few areas where we see a change in patterns of thoughts. At least in 1994, the Oslo Accords, the first time that there was an actual serious attempt to bring both sides to agree on anything, on something. So in 1994, fewer than 32% of the Jews in Israel still denied that Palestinians were a people. 20 years earlier, about 80% claimed that the Palestinians were not a people. So we see a huge change. 3, to enhance our cause, we must dehumanize and denigrate the enemy. The Muslim media and educational systems, kindergarten through universities, present materials that would make the Nazis proud. To a lesser degree, textbooks in Jewish schools portray Muslim as the aggressor in all aspects of the conflict and highlight the historical mistreatment of Jews in Arab lands since the emergence of Islam in the 7th century. One cannot underestimate the damage done to generations of children on both sides that are exposed to such powerful brainwashing. This is an insidious institutionalization of the negative patterns of thoughts we're discussing today. 4, the Jews, / Muslims, are violent, dishonest, and have little regard for human life. Both sides maintain that idea. Over 70% of Jews in one survey conducted this year in 2009 answered in the affirmative. Such a strong held belief may lead to a sense of hopelessness and helplessness and block any movement toward a negotiated settlement. As psychologists, I've learned that one of the worst feelings that a person can have is both feeling hopeless and helpless. And when I dealt with people that were highly depressed in either inpatient or outpatient settings, this, I would say, was the common denominator, hopelessness and helplessness. So we are dealing with what I would say two very depressed patients. We are, 5, we are the sole victims of this conflict. We do not recognize the suffering of the Jews or Muslims. Add to that the Holocaust denial, Abbas, the leader of the Palestinian Authority, had written a dissertation which one could summarize as basically in Holocaust denial. On the other hand, we have the Jews who are failing to acknowledge the dispossession of the Palestinians in 1948, what the Palestinians called the Nakba, the tragedy. This dysfunctional belief is widely held by the two communities. Each party will not allow for facts to shake the foundations of this belief. What is the consequence? Lack of empathy toward the other hinders understanding of the difficulties that followed the events of the 20th century. Cultivating empathy and compassion toward the opponent may help in overcoming the psychological barriers to conflict resolution. Number six, we will not assume any ownership of the problems created since the 1880s. The Jews / Muslims are the ones to blame for all of the hostilities, wars, dispossessions. This is a major, if not the major, obstacle to progress. Think about it. If you believe that it's all the other party's fault, why would you be obligated to make painful concessions? In treatment, it is paramount that each spouse assumes some degree of responsibility to the conflict. This act motivates the parties to assume a responsibility for the pursuit of change through negotiation, compromise, and a give-and-take approach. Just as a therapist guides a couple, negotiators, third parties, must guide the leadership of the Jewish state and the Muslim states to prepare the population for major changes in perception of the cost, should say the very high cost of peace. Arafat did not do that prior to Oslo or Camp David, as he feared the reaction of the Arab streets. The prime ministers of the Jewish state have to educate the right-wingers of the painful concessions necessary, concessions including the settlement blocks in the West Bank, the division of Jerusalem, and the moral obligation to assist the newly created Palestinian state. Number seven, Jerusalem in its entirety must remain under Jewish control. It must remain as the undivided capital of the Jewish state. This is an irrational thought, as it tends to undermine the Muslims' religious political views of the significance of the city to the Palestinian national identity. Despite the fact that the Jews annexed the eastern part of the city and declared their intention to keep it undivided, this position has to change. However, the resistance to change in regard to the above position by both parties appears to be insurmountable due to the religious significance of the holy places. So in addition to everything else, we have to deal with religious beliefs. The religious aspect may prove to be a mission impossible. I'm thinking about Bush and his mission impossible even for the trained mediator. Number eight, the Middle East is the domain of the Muslim Arab family of nations. There is no room for Jews infidels on our sacred Muslim lands. This is an all or nothing thinking, black or white, that leads to a dead end. How do you negotiate a position based in religious beliefs? It's rhetorical, of course. Time is on our side. The more we postpone the resolution phase, the more we have to gain. The Muslims maintain that the next agreement will provide for a better deal than the current agreement. The last one is always better than the previous one. The Jews, on the other hand, are known to make concessions with each deal. Therefore, the Arab-Palestinians are trapped in a mindset that will not allow for genuine progress nor consider the final phase of the settlement. The Jews, or a good number of them, believe that the passage of time plays in their favor by cementing, the Hebrew saying, the facts on the ground. For instance, the notion that a 40-year-old settlement is a legitimate one versus one whose tenure is much shorter. So that may not be legitimate. So it's really a matter of time. Number 10, Israel cannot make a peace that leaves any risk to its security. Treaties can be broken and agreements violated. We cannot, must not trust the other side. The pursuit of the perfect ideal security arrangement is the crux of the peace settlement. Although the latter may have some truth to it, the risk taken may be rewarded with major benefits to both Jews and Muslims. Seeking ironclad agreements will never advance the cause of peace. The Jews' need for guarantee or guarantees of security is understandable in light of the events of the last 2,000 years, and particularly the experience of the Holocaust, 1933 to 1945. Nevertheless, inaction or the pursuit of the ideal peace may assume or may assure that the Jews have be in a perpetual state of insecurity. One has to acknowledge that life is all about the assumption of risk at any step taken. Perfect solutions are not to be found. You have to assess the risk component, attempt to minimize it, and construct contingency plans to deal with violations and breakdowns that for sure are going to happen. However, the Jewish experience of the last 4,000 years may not make it amenable to change its perpetual state of hypervigilance and insecurity. I look at the Jews as a patient that had a great deal of trauma and now is in a post-trauma situation. And being in post-trauma, you're hyper-vigilant and you have a total sense of insecurity, even in San Francisco. I'm pointing at myself. We will not accept the legitimacy of a Jewish state in the Middle East. The Jews are European people with no claim to the land of Palestine. There was never a Jewish presence in the land. They are a Western imperialist power on Muslim land. They will corrupt our youth with Western-style ideas. They are not to be trusted as they are evil. This belief totally delegitimizes the opponent. By denying the historical reality of the Jewish presence in the area commencing 3,300 years ago, the claim, Jewish claim, to the holy places, the unbroken existence of Jewish communities in Palestine, one exception, during the Crusaders, there were no Jews for about 150 years in the area called Palestine. And the United Nations recognition of the State of Israel in 1948, the Muslims create a dead end to any resolution by saying that there's no room for that. And it's also interesting to note, for those of you who have not been to Israel, that over 50% of the Israelis are not European. They are actually Jews who came from Arab countries or all the way to India, you know, Pakistan, India, and so forth. So the European Jews constitute less than 49%. Number 12, terror is a legitimate act of resistance to occupation. Any citizen of the Jewish state is fair game. The perpetrator of acts resulting in mass death of civilians are heroes and martyrs. Such a strongly held belief is counterproductive to the pursuit of peace and tends to dehumanize people on the other side. It creates widespread fear with a strong urge to seek protection. The ideas reinforce the other side belief that the aim of the enemy is utter destruction. It leads to a vicious cycle of justification of extreme forms of violence as the ultimate measures of protection. The Gaza operation is one example of an extreme form of violence that is perceived by one side as we are protecting ourselves. Fear is a very strong emotion, and it's amazing that a state that has nuclear bombs is in a constant state of fear. And I'll tell you about my interactions with Israelis this year in 2009 that actually portray this point. Number 13. The law of return must be expended to all Muslims that identify themselves as refugees of the 1948 and 1967 wars. The United Nations defined refugees as residents of the British Mandatory Palestine with a two-year residency prior to 1948. Again, I'd like to mention that the British controlled the area called Palestine between 1917 and 1948. And any Arabs that resided in Palestine, which actually encompasses Jordan, between 1946 and 1948, are deemed to be Palestinian refugees. Another idea, it is the refugee's prerogative to determine whether he or she wishes to move to the Jewish state named Israel. This idea has to change in order to allow for any viable, not just, but any viable solution to the conflict. Otherwise, the influx of 1 million or 2 million Muslims into the Jewish state will destabilize the country and create de facto two or more Palestinian states, one on the West Bank, the second one in what is called Israel, and perhaps the third one in Gaza. This is another insurmountable barrier to any peaceful resolution. The empathic response of one nation of refugees, i.e. the Jews, is to resettle the dispossessed on their original land and homes. This is what empathy is all about. However, that did not happen in 1949 following the end of the 1948 war. The changes that have taken place in the last 61 years changed the topography and population balance of Mandatory Palestine. The Muslims believe that this is not an issue on which that they can offer any compromise. The Jews, on the other hand, do not wish to commit cultural and national suicide. It's nothing less than a Greek tragedy. The formula of admission of a token number of refugees into the Jewish state, granting citizenship rights to refugees at various Arab countries where they reside, and monetary compensation may not address the perceived injustice in the pursuit of what I call the perfect solution. Is that another all-or-nothing form of thought? Is this problem that cannot be justly resolved even by the best-trained mediator? Will this issue assure the continuation of the conflict into the 22nd century? 100 years. Number 14, the Jews need to be held to different moral and ethical standards. We Muslims reserve the right to engage in any behavior as despicable as it is, as long as we define it to be part of our resistance. Firing unguided projectiles into civilian areas and bombing wedding receptions are legitimate activities. However, Jews are not allowed to engage in identical activities because we Muslim, and I have to admit, the world as a whole, the nations of the world, hold Jews to different ethical standards of behavior. The change should call for application of identical standards and codes to both parties. What is the psychological message relayed here? Is one nation different than all the others? Number 15, we Muslims, we have Muslims who are part of the Palestinian Authority on the West Bank. Then we have Palestinians who reside in Gaza and are led by a different faction called Hamas. So we Muslims can pursue peace while having two feuding factions with control over different parts of our nation. Such an idea contradicts any line of reasoning. How confident can the other side be of commitments made by one faction that negates what the other side holds to be true and sacred. The two factions see things entirely differently. As long as there is no genuine unity government, one should not expect the other side to engage in serious negotiations. Here, I'm talking to psychologists. Dealing with two feuding spouses in treatment is quite challenging. Introducing a third one will increase the complexity of the case. I'm sure that Tiger Woods would attest to that. Will the psychologist wish to engage a spouse with a split personality? And those of you who have any experience dealing with psychologists, that's an area that is not amenable to change. We do not have the skills as psychologists to deal with split personalities. Which one of the personalities will the psychologist address? I fear that this issue is another nail in the coffin of the Middle East peace. At best, it is a temporary one. Will a tortured soul with multiple injuries, such as the Jewish people, talking about trauma, wish to engage with the force calling for their demise? Would the children of Holocaust survivors, such as myself, that pled never again, not take the threat as a serious one? The history of the Jewish people made them hyper-vigilant when it comes to nation that preach the final solution of the Jewish problem. So we have, I don't have to go back to Nazi Germany of the 1930s, we have a part of the Palestinian nation in Gaza that is allied with a nation like Iran that actually talks in very similar terms of the final solution to the Jewish problem. I mean, whenever I say that, I can feel my heart pumping. 16, our conduct should not have any consequences. We are entitled to reset the clock at any time we wish. Any act of commission or omission should not be held against us. Guess who holds that point of view? The rules of nature should not apply to us. It is known in developmental psychology that there are a number of windows that open and close at certain phases of the developing child. There are severe consequences in a case where there are delays or total failure of the organism, the child, to take advantage of that window. Depriving the child of adequate nutrition may cause irreparable and irreversible damage. The lost developmental windows of opportunity for the developing infant Palestinian state in the 1920s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and particularly 1990s, 1994, all the way to the year 2000, resulted in irreversible damage to that infant I call the Palestinian state. The psychologist mediator who wishes to replay the game by setting the clock back to the couple's courtship days is engaging in magical and wishful thinking. Acceptance of the painful reality is an indicator of a mature adult. So it's not a matter of right or wrong. As an adult, and all of us in here are adults, we've learned to accept certain realities that are very painful. Nevertheless, we had to accept them. Number 17. The West Bank and Eastern Jerusalem are liberated land, not occupied lands. God gave the land to his chosen people. Although that may be debated by theologians, it is still a self-defeating idea. The Muslim and the nations of the world view those areas as occupied. The Jewish state cannot fly in the face of the world while still maintaining commercial ties to it. The well-adjusted spouse has at times to change a strongly held belief in order to achieve a larger reward down the road. It is not about justice as much about the ability to survive and hopefully allow your children a better future. Being dead right still leaves you dead. Thus, what have you achieved? You are dead. It is noteworthy that a large segment of the Jewish population has accepted the reality of territorial concessions and withdrawal due primarily to the demographic threat looming over the democratic Jewish state. Number 18, getting closer to the end, the whole world is against us. I'm sure you've heard that. This is a widely held belief by Jews of the area. My mom used to use that almost on a daily basis. Whether this is paranoia or a statement of fact, this belief may lead to a fortress mentality that calls for concrete barriers, fortified borders, and a reliance on a potent military force. By definition, it is false. It is a false belief, as not 100% of diaspora Jews and not 100% of Gentiles in this world are against the Jewish state. And I will explain it later on. 19, there is no partner for peace. The Jews claim that pulling out of territories in southern Lebanon and the Gaza Strip was followed by extreme forms of aggression. Pulling back to the internationally recognized boundaries in Lebanon did not result in peace. The Muslim, on the other hand, claim that the Jews continue to confiscate Muslim land, build illegal settlements, and Judaize Jerusalem, surrounding Jerusalem with Jewish neighborhoods from all sides. Thus, if you accept the mantra that the past behaviors are indicative of future behaviors, what is there to expect? Is this a rational or irrational belief? In conclusion, I got to drink some water because it's there. Wiser men than I have declared that at least for now, the Middle East conflict is intractable. In a recent published article in the New York Times, not a right-wing newspaper or what I would call a pro-Israeli paper, Thomas Friedman stated that, and I quote you, it is time to call a halt to this dysfunctional peace process, which is only damaging the Obama's team credibility. Roger Cohen, a famous Middle Eastern scholar, British, in the same publication, New York Times, just 2 weeks ago, stated, I've grown so pessimistic about the Israel-Palestine issue that I found myself agreeing with no less than Avigdor Lieberman, the hardline foreign minister of Israel. And to call him hardline is an understatement. So here's Mr. Cohen, who is quite liberal, agrees with Mr. Lieberman, and I'm quoting what Mr. Lieberman said, that anyone who says that within the next few years an agreement can be reached ending the conflict simply does not understand the situation and spreads delusions. It's translated from the Hebrew into the English. In the last several months, President Obama has invested U.S. time and prestige only to become bogged down in the party's delay and avoidance. Sounds like a movie I've seen many, many a times. The problem is that the current peace process is actually making peace less likely. As long as mediators fail to address each party's core dysfunctional and often irrational belief systems, there can be no real progress. And the longer we engage in a process that produces no results, the less people are interested in continuing this difficult, painful exercise. And this is what we're seeing now. People are apathetic at best. At worst, they are more eager than ever to initiate another spasm of violence just to disrupt the status quo. There's a lot of fear that things may explode soon. Change is, however, possible. Couples work out their problems and change their way of thinking. Years later, it is difficult for them to remember just why they were so bitter about problems that had concrete solutions. The example, the European experience. Europe is been engaged in wars for hundreds of years, the 100-year war, which actually lasted, I believe, about 130 years. Today in Europe, with the exception of Bosnia, we've had peace, or relative peace, since 1945. For those of you who studied the European history, that's unheard of. You know, so I am somewhat of an optimist. Also, as a psychologist in dealing with couples, you know, I did not have 100% success. I'd say more like, how vain am I? 20%? So there is a chance. And I would like to end with a quote and a challenge to you to actually identify the person that said those words. So here's the quote. Yet there remains another wall. This wall constitutes a psychological barrier between us, a barrier of suspicion, rejection, fear, deception, a barrier of distorted and eroded interpretations of every event and statement. Today, through my visit to you, I ask, why don't we stretch out our hands with faith and sincerity so that together we might destroy this barrier? A volunteer? Okay. Anwar Sadat, Israeli Knesset, November 29th, 1977. Talking about the barrier, the psychological barriers to peace. And was that good, 30 minutes?
Okay. That was wonderful. Thanks to Emmanuel Jalish for his comments today. And we have many questions, so we're going to keep you up at that podium. And if anybody else in the audience has any questions or thoughts or comments, please send them on up. So I am going to get started. First of all, talking about your framework, psychological approach. So you outlined this approach to dealing with Middle East peace and discussed some of the recent failings. Have there been any successes to the counseling?
Yes, and that is another psychological force that we have to deal with, which the two parties tend to undermine and underestimate any the slightest movement toward peace. They say, it don't count. It's not a real move. They tend to underestimate and undermine it. You want me to be concrete, right?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Well, we do have some good news. If you look at the state, three states, in fact, Israel, Egypt, Israel, Jordan. We have what I will call, the Israelis call it a peace. I call that a more of a no-war situation where we have not had any major hostilities between the Egyptians and the Israelis and the Jordanians and the Israelis for many years. With the Egyptians, since 1973, there were a few skirmishes here and there, but nothing serious and nothing that I can think of the last 20 years. So there is hope. Another sign of hope is the West Bank. Since everything is relative, and those of you who visited the West Bank, I'm one of them. I was there in April, March and April in the West Bank. It's relatively quiet. I mean, we do have incidents, but if you look at the Intifada periods, the year 2000, 2001, 2002, with, I repeat, hundreds of incidents per day, to perhaps one or two per week, that is definitely progress. So the West Bank makes me feel that, yes, there is some hope.
Going off the idea of hope, in the 90s, Yitzhak Rabin created so much hope among the Israeli people. I have a good friend who had taken two trips to Israel, one in 92, where that hope was palpable, and then one after the assassination, where that hopelessness and helplessness had really taken hold. As we try to progress toward a place where there's more hope, you know, that danger exists, yes, that someone's going to come out and try to knock it down. Do you think the two groups are able to withstand that this time?
Yeah, I mean, this is like a very bad movie.
Thank you.
I'm trying to think of the name of the movie where this guy had to relive the very day, day after day after day. I can hear you. Groundhog Day. To me, the Middle East is the ground, the epitome of what this movie was about. I mean, it just goes on and on and on, and it's the same script. Every time that the two parties are moving closer, there is a major incident, a major, I call it a terrorist act. Some people call it a liberation and resistance to occupation. Nevertheless, people die, explosions, assassinations. So that is part of the script, you're right. And to me, you know, I'm torn. On one hand, I'm an optimist, and my wife who sits there would actually testify to it. We've been together for 42 years. You've got to be an optimist to stay in this with the same wife for 42 years, right? So I am the eternal optimist. Nevertheless, I have to face reality. Rabin did not have to deal with some of the intractable issues that I, for one, with all of my training, do not have an answer to. As I mentioned, the issue of the refugees. This is tragic because there is no solution that will be accepted by Party A or Party B. And I'm just talking about two parties. We also have Iran, you know, so we're talking about a third party involvement. The issue of Jerusalem, in my view, cannot be solved. Yes, we have a solution. Those of you who have seen and read the accords of Oslo, Camp David, then Taba, which was the third phase, I've read some of it, not all of it. It's like, you know, universal health care. Who's going to read 1,200 pages, you know? Those are 400, 500, 600-page documents. So it's very specific. They address every issue. In fact, when we talk about Jerusalem, we already have maps that are very specific. This street goes to Party A. This street goes to Party B. Even which block goes to whom. You cannot get more specific than that. So what I'm saying, the formula is known, but the couple does not want to even acknowledge each other.
So speaking of the couple not wanting to acknowledge each other, one audience member asks, if we already use the cognitive therapy model, what is the success rate of cognitive therapy in couples counseling?
Who asked that? You know, a psychologist? Oh, okay. In fact, the answer is actually a positive answer. Most therapies are... I'm a retired psychologist, so I can actually be honest. Most therapies are ineffective, you know. Cognitive therapy is very effective given certain disorders. For example, if you deal with anxiety disorders, phobias, that I know quite a bit about phobias, the success rate is in the 70s and 80s. Depression in the 50s and 60s, where most treatments in psychology are talking about single digits. When I used to deal, I'm not a specialist with the drug addiction. You're talking about between 3 to 5% success rate, which means 97 to 95% failure rate. We're not failing. We're attempting to resolve issues. So cognitive therapy is very successful in dealing with certain issues. That's my answer.
Okay. So you presented your another question from the audience. You presented your views within the framework of a feuding couple, but what role is played by third parties, other Arab states, non-Arab Muslims, the U.S., Europe, the people themselves?
Huge role. Huge. It's like having a mother-in-law or a father-in-law, you know, standing there behind the curtain. We had, during the 1950s and 60s, we had the Russians. I'm talking about this in Israeli. The Russians to deal with. The USSR had absolutely no interest in introducing forget peace. The Russians didn't think about no hostilities. They were very much steering the pot. And now we have Iran, And I understand why Iran is doing it. You know, it's not just, as my mother would say, anti-Semitism. You know, they hate Jews. I think Iran has an interest in causing trouble because they view themselves as the replacement of Egypt. Egypt used to be the leading force in the Middle East in the 50s and 60s, no longer. Now Iran has a claim to the title. And one of the ways to do it is to show allegiance with the Palestinians and causing a lot of trouble.
For what purpose? If they're supposed to be the driver of the Middle East, what do you
want
to achieve?
How else would you achieve the label, the title of the protector of the Muslim world? The Iranians are not Arabs, you know, but they are Muslims and devout Muslims. So in my view, and that's my own personal view, that is the reason why they're doing it.
Do you have any thoughts on, you know, we're talking about the Israelis and the Palestinians sort of sitting down and trying to hammer out some of these issues, but you're right, there's a lot going on outside. So how would one deal with, I mean, everyone's trying to figure out how to deal with Iran. What are your thoughts on how to neutralize that or make it work for you?
To me, at this point, there's not much that can be done. And I don't want to sound pessimistic, but there isn't very much. In my view, if the Arab states as a whole, okay, as a bloc, were to do something unheard of, and perhaps even utopian, is unilaterally accept the existence of the state of Israel. I'm not saying that they should love the Jews and have commerce and tourism and cultural exchanges. Just the mere fact of accepting the state of Israel unconditionally. I'm sure that one in the audience will tell me, well, the Saudi Arabians have tried that. You know, the Saudi Arabians advanced a paper that actually called for the recognition of the state of Israel. However, I read the whole proposal. The proposal had the poison pill. And what is the poison pill in the Middle East? We talked about that. The refugees. The Saudi Arabians said, okay, we will move toward acknowledging that the state of Israel does exist. Okay. However, in order for the state of Israel to get our recognition, they must unconditionally allow any person that deems himself to be a Palestinian to have the right of return. And that, I think, is a noble kind of value. I mean, we all would like to find a settlement of this issue, but that settlement would result in the death of another nation. And that nation, like any human organism, will fight to their death, not to die. You know, it's a human drive to survive. So the Saudi Arabians are quite smart. They entered the poison pill, and that totally nullified the beautiful proposal raised by them.
So one of the audience members wants to know about applying international law and human rights to solve the conflict. I mean, would that do it? Are there some basic laws out there that could be applied to get everybody on the same page?
International law. You know, let me talk about refugees and show you how international law can actually harm the cause of the refugees. What I've learned, and again, I'm not an attorney, and I am very careful when I talk about legalese, but what I read is that the world, the United Nations, views refugees as people that were forcibly moved from point A to point B. Example, if you look at me, I am a refugee. But am I? My parents were not allowed to return to the very homes that they left, one in Russia and the other one is Slovakia. My parents were refugees. To make this issue more complex, the United Nations does not view me as a refugee, even though I am. They do not view me because I'm a son of the refugee. So the United Nations, based on international law, says that refugees are only people, the very people that were forcibly moved, which de facto means that most of what we deem to be Palestinian refugees are not refugees. They were born in areas outside of what we deem to be Palestine. So it's very dangerous to talk about international law because it could work against you.
Okay, I want to talk a little bit about the U.S. and their historical role and their current role in the Middle East peace process. First, one audience member asks your impression of the roadmap proposed by the Bush administration.
Well, all those plans and programs are very well intentioned, and there is a lot of thought that was given to them, all of them. There is one failure, and that failure, and that's why I said is why Obama is doomed to failure. And I think I just spoke to it with my wife just prior to coming in today, and there is some understanding on my part, at least, that Obama is giving up on the Middle East. Of course, he's got the universal health care to deal with, but I see signs that the United States is following Mr. Friedman's suggestion and is pulling out. To me, the major issue, and some of you may not agree, and I accept that, is that the two spouses have to acknowledge and recognize each other. If I do not recognize my spouse as a human entity, as a human being, what is there to discuss? You know, divorce, perhaps, you know? How do you divorce a non-entity, by the way? So to me, the major issue here is that one party is unwilling to accept the existence of the second party. So some people may say, well, the PLO has made certain moves. But I would urge all of you to Google Palestinian Media Watch. It's an organization that its aim is to watch anything within the Arab countries, newspapers, TV, whatever. And watched a few videos just the other day, and they show that that is not true. There's no recognition of the state of Israel. There's not even a map. I challenge all of you, and there is one person here from the very same area where I come from Palestine, that show me one map by a Palestinian entity or an Arab entity that has Israel within it. If you challenge me, you know you have the best dinner in town. You name it, you got it. You know, it does not exist.
So you talked about the feuding couple, but there's also the, you know, the people that they have to deal with before they can even come together. It seems, you know, there are some questions here from both sides of the audience, the Hamas-Fatah conflict on the Palestinian side, the moderates versus the right wing on the Israeli side. You know, before some sort of solution can be reached, is there a responsibility to get everyone on the same page or to try to find some sort of common thread on your own side?
On my side?
On one's own side.
A common thread. Well, you see, Israel is a democracy for the Jewish people. I would acknowledge that if you are a Palestinian, you would not deem the state of Israel to be democratic. But there is democracy, and I do not concur with the idea of the right and the left. Mm-hmm. In my view, is once there will be, hopefully, movement toward peace, the Israelis will, I call it checkmated, they will be forced into accepting the terms of Oslo, of the Quartet. There will be movement. I do not see the Israeli government survive, whether it's government of the right, the center, or left, survive by denying the stretched hand. You know, look what happened in 1977. Sadat, the arch enemy of Israel, 4 years prior to that, the Israelis, the Arabs, the Egyptians fought a terrible war, the 1973 war, terrible war, with thousands and thousands of people dying. 4 years later, Sadat made a gesture. You know, he stretched, as he said, he stretched his hand and said, this is a psychological conflict. You know, let's resolve it. He moved Israel to the table. And once he came, I'm sure there was some pre-negotiation. He didn't just show up one day in Jerusalem. But once he moved from, what do I call it, point A to point B, he was able to overcome the psychological barriers that said to him, I cannot acknowledge the state of Israel. We had peace, I think, within 2 years between the Egyptians and Israelis.
Do you foresee that happening again with?
In my lifetime?
Yes.
Okay, I intend to be around for 32 more years. Make it 38. No, I do not see that. As I said, we are dealing with a number of actors. The Palestinian Authority, Hamas, they have to get their act together. There is no way to have peace. I literally call that a split personality. And a person with a split personality is a very sick individual. In the old days, we used to call them psychotics. We just changed in the last few years. But they are mentally ill. And if that were a patient, a person. So it's impossible. I don't see any way between Iran, Hamas, Hezbollah on the... we forgot to talk about the northern border. Mm-hmm. We have a northern border. We have a southern border. I would like to see, in my son's time, I'd like to see some movement. I do not see anything within the next, say, 10, 20 years.
Do you see a softening in the younger generations? Has there been any change of psychology or change?
No, and I just want to say that I don't know how much time we have. I'll just say
just a couple minutes. Yeah.
2 minutes, and I'll say, to me, an eye-opener was my last visit to Israel, February to April of this year. I spent 2 months in Israel, and I have lots of friends. I shouldn't say lots of friends, acquaintances. I've learned to say that, not friends. Very few friends, lots of acquaintances. And I made a point to talk to as many people as I could in Israel. And with all modesty, I would say I talked to probably about between 80 to 90 people about Middle East. Most of my friends in Israel are center-left to the left, okay? And one exception, but most of them are on the left. And I was amazed. In my visits in Israel previously, we used to spend hours and hours discussing, debating, arguing the Middle East conflict. At this time, 2 months, not one person, God is my witness, not one person raised the issue. I had to come up with a question. I can be very provocative, sometimes too much so. So I raised questions, and most people told me we're tired of it. Now, this is the Israeli left, not the right wingers. Mm-hmm. We're tired of it. There is no solution to the conflict. They said the best that we can achieve as Israelis is crisis management. And they told me that this is a lost generation. They were talking about themselves, and they were talking about the other side. So a generation is 25 years. They do not see anything happening within the next 25 years. In fact, the younger generation, in my view today, is becoming more radicalized on both sides. And so if there is a sense, I talked about pessimism, we got that. Hopelessness, helplessness, we've got that. And it's very sad, and it makes me very unhappy. What can I say?
Yeah, I can understand that. So to try to infuse a little bit of hope to the end of our talk here tonight, we have time for one more question. And you've talked about your views on whether or not you think Obama will be successful. You know, this year he's been dealing with healthcare, the economy, Afghanistan, and I believe, you know, it may still be his goal to get into the Middle East there. What does he need to do? What does the U.S. need to do to really get in there and push this thing in a new direction?
Being a biased person, I would say, I go back to my point, Obama made one try in his Cairo speech. He was trying to move Saudi Arabia and some of the so-called more conservative, that's a whole lecture right there, conservative countries of the Middle East to show, to make a gesture. I don't know if you listen or read that. Make a gesture, and he failed drastically. They did not do it. In my view, I want to finish on an optimistic note. As I said, I'm talking about intractable solutions. Even dealing with people that had substance abuse problems, our success rate was still 3 to 5%. Okay, so there is hope. You know, it's not 100% failure. So there is hope. In my view, the only hope is if the Arab countries as a bloc will unconditionally just recognize one thing, the mere existence of the state of Israel. Forget loving Israel. Just acknowledge the state exists and change the maps. Suddenly, you know, we see Israel appear in Arab maps. To me, that would be not just a drastic change. It would make me feel as though we're moving the right direction.
Our thanks to Emmanuel Jolish, PhD in psychology, for his comments this evening. We also thank our audiences here on the radio, television, and internet. I'm Gina Valeria, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you very much for your questions.